Thank you for listening to this teaching from Forerunner Fellowship. For more teachings or to subscribe to our podcast, as well as information about our congregation, visit our website at forerunnerfellowship.org.
All right, well, this is the fourth session in the Culture of Prayer series, and this session is entitled David's Heart After God. And so I want to give you a little bit of context specifically related to David. As the warrior king that we all are familiar with, especially from, I mean, he is such the character that children's ministry is like, that is one of the easiest guys to do children's stories about, because there's so many of the adventurous stories. But I think that because of some of the ways that there's a caricature of David, we missed a lot of details about his life. If we are not careful to go through his life from the Word, we could get this this maybe inflated or inaccurate view of who David is. So I want to give you some of the background to really just paint the picture of who David was. So first off, David, and I'm going to kind of round, but David was born around 1070 BC, so about nearly 1,100 years before Christ was born. And he was born into a generation that the Ark of the Covenant, and we're going to get into a lot of detail here specifically about the Ark of the Covenant, but he was born into a climate where Israel was in transition. He was born where there was the period of the judges, and then it transitioned into the kings of Israel, starting off with Saul. But he was born into a spiritual climate that was not great. It was not healthy. There were a lot of the ways that Israel, the people of God, were wayward. They were not following the Lord, and it was a generation that had purpose, that had specific agenda items for that generation to do, and he was born into that. So the Word of God makes some statements about David that are unique, that aren't said about other people, that set him apart. I don't think that whenever these verses were penned about David, that they were, you know, exaggerating or talking, you know, being generous. They were factual statements, calculated statements. And thankfully, they were preserved so that generations after David would be able to look at them, read the account of David's life, and then gain something from it to be inspired by. And so the way that this unique testimony from heaven's perspective is laid out is set up as a witness for us. It's intended not just to be a story of one of the men and women of faith, so that we can say, oh, you know, this person had faith, they lived this life, but it's something above and beyond that. You know, even when we read in Hebrews the story of all the ways that we can take faith because of the way that the whole list of people walked with God, it's more than that. It's even more unique than that, and we're going to get into some of that. Part of what we're going to be looking at really kind of hinges on this vow that David makes as a youth. It's estimated that he's probably 12, 13, something like that. Whenever he is a young shepherd boy out in the fields, we can piece together some of the storyline of how David grew up, what his family life was like. We can kind of get an idea of kind of the climate that he was alive in, specifically related to how the people of Israel viewed God, how they viewed how they viewed their relationship to God, and some of these details piece together this picture of how David grew up. So he's born into this climate where there's kind of a disregard for the presence of God. There's a disregard for who God is. There is a climate that places little importance on the people's relationship to God, And David, as a young boy, takes issue with it. It would have been so easy for David to have grown up just like all the other boys of Israel and kind of followed suit and do as their fathers did. But David did something different. He took issue with the way that God was treated, was viewed, was regarded in his generation. And as a young boy, I'm thinking of, you know, as a 12-year-old, I've got a 12-year-old, and I think of the ideas and the vows, the expressions, the things that my 12-year-old come up with, and I view those in comparison with what David vowed, and I think about heaven's perspective, heaven's listening ear to what David said. In Psalm 132, this vow is recorded of a preteen making a statement that is, it's unusual because, you know, I think about, you know, even just as recently as yesterday, Ava, my 12-year-old, was asking, can we go get another journal? I've already run out of pages and it's, you know, it's filled up. I'm thinking about these journal entries of a young shepherd boy. He's making these statements, but it's not just written down in some journal that's going to be put away in a bookshelf. His journal entry, this vow that he makes, ends up as inspired word of God and into the Bible, passed down generations to generation. And it's interesting that heaven not only viewed it, but two, regarded it as inspired word of God. So let's take a look at this. Psalm 132. It says, Lord, remember David and all his self-denial. He swore an oath to the Lord. He made a vow to the mighty one of Jacob. Now, this is the statement that he makes as a youth, as a 12, 13-year-old, 14-year-old, whatever the age was. I will not enter my house or go to my bed. I will allow no sleep to my eyes or slumber to my eyelids until I find a place for the Lord, a dwelling for the mighty one of Jacob. This is unique. This is dramatic that a 12-year-old would think about the spiritual condition of his nation and begin to take responsibility and say, not on my watch. If I have anything to do with it, if I have any way to influence, if I have any way that I can change the spiritual climate, if there's a way that I can repair the relationship that my people, that my nation has with God, I'm going to do it. And I'm serious about it. And he goes so far as like, I'm going to be relentless about this. And there's this kind of like pit bull in his heart. And he's like, I'm going to get a hold of this and I'm going to do something about it. And heaven took notice of it. And it's like, oh my gosh. I mean, I love my kids, but to take something that they say so seriously like this, heaven saw something different about David that I don't think anyone else was looking at. We get the picture of the way that David grew up as kind of the runt of his brothers, and it's like he was really disregarded. He was kind of ignored. He was kind of put off and not really taken seriously. But that's not how heaven saw him. Heaven saw something different. Heaven was looking at the heart of the matter, and God said, I heard that, David, and it's important, and I believe you, and my hand's going to be with you, and you're going to do it. You're going to help do something in your generation. Many times whenever we think about the things that people say, sometimes because we're weak humans, it's kind of the phrase, you know, it's more about what you do than what you say. And we can look at David's life and look at what he said and know that not only did he make this vow, but he made good on it. And so we can look at the life work of David. And yes, he was, you know, one of Jesse's sons. Yes, he was a king. Yes, he was a warrior. Yes, he was a giant slayer. Yes, he did all these things. But there's something unique that he did. And we're going to look at his relationship to starting a new expression of the priesthood. There was already an expression of the priesthood up until this point. For about 500 or 600 years, the Ark of the Covenant had been the central part of the tabernacle of Moses, and the Levitical priesthood was centered around the way that they ministered to the Lord. This was already well established. But what we're going to look at is how David, because of the zeal for the house of God, for the zeal to establish a resting place for the mighty one of Jacob, he did something outlandish. There were already things written into the code, into the Levitical priesthood, that was like, if you do this, bad things happen, like you can die. There's certain ways, and there's certain bloodlines, and there's specific ways to approach God in a very prescribed manner that if you don't do that, bad things happen. You can die from that. But David took the vow in his heart and did an outlandish thing, a very bold thing, a risky thing. He established a new version of a priesthood. And we're going to look at that here in just a second. But as I was saying, he was born into a time that was spiritually kind of broken. David was born about 40 years after the unthinkable happened. The Israelites were faced with battle many times by their neighbors, and one of the things that they would do is they would take the presence of God, represented and kind of centered around the Ark of the Covenant, which was a box. It was actually made of wood, and it had dimensions to it, and there were articles that went into it, and God chose to represent his presence on the earth kind of inside and around this box. And what would happen is the Ark of the Covenant, which would be carried on poles, was taken around throughout the desert, but then also whenever they landed into the Promised Land, it represented and hosted the presence of God. Well, during one of the battles, the Israelites took the Ark of the Covenant into battle, and it was captured. God is not supposed to be able to be captured by the enemy in a battle. That's not supposed to happen, but what ends up happening is the Philistines capture God's presence. They take it from Israel, and they take it behind enemy lines. Now, as unthinkable and tragic as that is, probably more tragic is the response of the people of Israel. They didn't go back and get it. God's presence was forcefully taken from them and put behind enemy lines into the hands of the enemy, and they did nothing about it. It's an indicator of what was going on in the climate, in the spiritual relationship of the children of Israel at that time. The ark was captured by the Philistines. Now, you can read the story. What ends up happening is, as it's there, behind enemy lines, it goes very bad for them. Cancer breaks out. They get infestations of different vermin. I mean, there's things that are happening, and they're like, this is not good. Their idols are falling down, and I mean, it goes bad for them, and they recognize, something's different in our land. When did this start happening? Oh, it's when we captured the Ark of the Covenant from the enemy is when all these bad things started happening. Let's get rid of it. And so they attach it to some cows, and they send it off, and the cattle go off, and the Lord directs the cattle to take it back to Israel, and the Philistines actually get relief from all of the cancer and the plagues that they were facing because of the Ark of the Covenant. And so it wasn't that the Israelites went back and got it. God had to rescue himself. He sent his own SEAL team to go get himself out. Well, his cow team. But they send, God gets cows to send the ark back into the Holy Land, into Israel. And it doesn't even go back to where it was supposed to go. It doesn't go back to the tabernacle of Moses. It goes and rests on a hill just outside of Jerusalem. And it sits there, and it isn't regarded, it isn't cared for in the way that it was prescribed to be cared for. God's presence wasn't tended to in the way that it was supposed to. And it sits there for a whole generation. And it's in the midst of this that the leadership, starting with Eli and then into Samuel and then eventually whenever King Saul takes reign, that this spiritual climate, the presence of God, had been forcefully taken and then not valued enough to go recapture it. But God rescued himself and then was set up and kind of put off out by the side, out away from where everyone else was and kind of forgotten. And you can see the way that this was an indicator of the spiritual climate. This was such a tragedy. I think about, there's this verse, 1 Samuel 4:21. This is when Eli hears that the Ark of the Covenant was captured. His grandson was about to be born. The way that this unfolds is tragedy all around. The spiritual leadership ends up dying as a result of the Ark of the Covenant being captured. Eli and his two sons they die, and one of the children, it was a grandchild of Eli, is named Ichabod, which means no glory. Like, the presence of God is not there. There's no glory in the land. I think about that, and it's like, wow. It was such a marking moment for the nation. It would kind of be like, on a family level, if you named your kid, like, bankruptcy, and it's like, the kid goes to an interview, is like, hi, I'm bankruptcy, and you're like, that's a very interesting name. It was the spiritual condition. They were bankrupt. They were okay with no glory. They were okay with the presence of God not being with them. The glory of God had departed from Israel. So David was born into this, and he took issue with it. There was a crisis in the land, and it wasn't just the crisis of the enemies surrounding them. It was a crisis of a lack of the presence of God, and David was not okay with it. This is kind of painful because I think about the church in America, and I think about what is our view as the church of a whole. You know, there's differing levels of care from congregation to congregation, but I think about the church in America right now and many of the issues that we're facing, and I think I kind of believe that the church in America is okay, that there's no presence of God, that there's no glory. I think that there's a bit of apathy, that there's kind of this resting of the church in America, and it's like, yeah, there's no presence of God, there's no revival, and we're kind of okay with business as usual. And that's a painful reality. David became a man of unusual dedication. Even from his youth, heaven took notice. And heaven's perspective was different. You know, the word says that the eyes of the Lord range to and fro to look for hearts that are loyal to him, hearts that belong to him. And I believe they found one in David. I want to look at the way that heaven's perspective was taking notice of David. 1 Samuel 13. So this is after Eli had died, the Ark of the Covenant's captured. Samuel did his run as one of the judges and the prophets in the land, and then the children of Israel cry out for a king. They're crying out, we want to be like the nations around us. And so they're given a king. They're, you know, it's be careful what you ask for. They're given a king that they ask for, King Saul. And he ends up making decisions that are not trusting of the Lord, and his kingdom ends up being taken from him. In 1 Samuel 13, 14, this moment is kind of capturing the transition. This is Samuel prophesying to King Saul after he made the decision to act in a way that was not appropriate regarding his kingship. And it says, "But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command." I think about this statement. I think about if, you know, and Saul was upset about this. Saul responded and he grabs a hold of the robe of Samuel and he like rips. He's like, "No, Samuel." And he grabs and rips Samuel's robe. And this is the response. And he says, "The kingdom has been torn from you," kind of in the same way that you just ripped my robe, dude. Like, the kingdom's taken from you. It's going to be ripped from you. If Saul was upset about that, if Saul would have known the man after God's own heart that God was talking about was a 12-year-old, I think that would have made him even more intense and more upset. I think about the way that God viewed David as a preteen, called him a man after God's own heart. What's interesting about that is that statement was made as he's a youth, before he did any of the stuff. Equally, what I think is what is interesting in the way that that the Bible views David's life is we know the mess ups that David did. We know the way that he stole a friend's wife and then had his friend murdered by putting him in the front lines in battle. We know of the ways that he did that, or the indiscretion, the great sinful failure that he committed about that. But even after all is said and done, the things that David did, of course, As a weak human, he has these failings, but then all of the things that he does in his lifetime to establish a resting place. I think about the way that the Bible characterizes David's life after he's gone is also pretty astonishing. In Acts 13, 1,000 years later, after David's been dead, it says this: "For David had, after he had served the purposes of God in his own generation, fell asleep and was laid among his fathers." There was something about David. Yes, he was weak. Yes, he made mistakes. Yes, he did atrocious things. But there was something about David that captured heaven's attention. There was something about David that characterizes him after he's dead and gone as one who served the purposes of his generation. And so we're going to get into that here in just a second. One last verse before we begin looking at how he accomplished this. Isaiah 55 talks about David's life and how we can look to it as a witness. It says this: "Give ear and come to me. Hear me, that your soul may live." That's kind of a dramatic statement for the Bible to kind of threefold say, "Hey, listen. No, hey, really listen. Okay, pay attention to this. I want you to hear what I'm saying. I'll make an everlasting covenant with you. My faithful love promised to David." And in the New King James, it calls it the sure mercies of David. "See, I've made him a witness to the peoples, a leader and a commander of the peoples." There was something about David's life that set him apart and set him up as a witness, as one who was a recipient of the sure mercies of God. He was one who found the mercies of God, the faithfulness of God, the faithful love that was promised to him as a result of the life that he lived and the confidence that he derived. I read some of the Psalms of David. I think about Psalm 18 specifically. And it's like, David saw something different about God. There's revelation given to David that was different. It's not in the notes, but in Psalm 18, there's this passage that just, man, it marks me. He says, "God delighted in me. He delivered me because he delighted in me." The reason that God delivered me from all of the different things was because God delighted in me. David saw something about God that others did not. He saw God as one who was very near and able to approach, and one who was loving, one who was steadfast, one who was faithful. And David approached God in a way that was unusual, especially in that generation. The way that David lived became the barometer for all kings to follow. Did you know that in the list of the kings, there's this unique phrase that is stated: this king did all of the different actions in his kingship, and then it gives a summary statement, and it's always measured back to David. A lot of times the statement that you'll read is, "And so-and-so did good in the eyes of the Lord because he did as his father David did," or "he did not do as his father did." David's life became a barometer. Also kind of related to that, did you know that there are 8 seasons of what we would characterize as revival related to the different kings in Israel? It happens to be that those same seasons of revival, and I'm talking about there's peace from their enemies, there's a measure that you would look at the spiritual climate of, oh, the people of God are actually following in the ways of approaching God. They're making efforts to make right with the Lord. All of those seasons are the same seasons that are characterized. They did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, and they did as their father David did. Well, what was it that David did? When David was a young man, he made this vow. Heaven takes notice and says, "This is a man after my own heart." As probably 17, 18, 19 years old, that's when Samuel goes into his town and calls for the dinner. This is when Saul was still king. Samuel comes into the land, and everyone is like, "Oh no, the prophet's here." And they're like, "What is he going to do?" None of Samuel's words have ever fallen. His prophecies have always come true. And they're like, "Oh no, we're about to," like, I think the people of Bethlehem knew, like, "Oh, we're not that great with God right now. I think we could like really end up in a bad way. I think that there could be judgment coming. If Samuel's coming to town, this is probably not good news." So Samuel's coming, and they're like, you know, I don't know if they're like, oh, like trying to do last minute repentance. I don't know if you guys have ever had this moment, but I remember early on when we were kind of becoming familiar with like the prophetic ministry and stuff like that, there would be times where, this is kind of interesting that this happened, but when none of us had any type of prophetic gifting, somebody would be like, "Hey, my friend's uncle is coming to town, and he has like the gift of prophecy. He's going to set up this time where we can go and get prophetic words." I can remember thinking like, "Oh, that sounds really cool. Go get a prophetic word." Like driving to the thing, it's like, "Lord, I just repent of everything that I've ever done in my whole life and that one time." Like, because I didn't want to get called out in the meeting, like, you know, where I'm there around all my friends and like, "The Lord has some like really serious issues about this sin that you've been doing," or whatever. I'm like, "Oh, Lord, I'm sorry for all the things that I've ever done," you know. And so anyway, I wonder if it was something like that, you know, Samuel's coming to town and all these people are like running to their back rooms and like, "Oh Lord, please forgive me," like trying to do this last minute repentances or whatever. But Samuel comes to town and he's coming to anoint the next king of Israel. And he goes to the house of Jesse and he lines up all the sons of Jesse. Samuel at least has the tip-off that it's going to be a son of Jesse. So all the sons are lined up, and he goes, and the firstborn, the tallest, the most handsome son comes up, and he's like, "Surely this guy is it. I mean, he's a good-looking guy. He's strong and tall and all these other things, all the things that people would want in a king." And the Lord's like, "Nope, not that one." And so he goes each of the sons, and he goes through them all, and he's like, "Jesse, this is a really weird question, but do you have any more sons? Because I was supposed to come here and anoint one of your sons, but the Lord has not given me the clearance on any of these. Do you have more sons? Question mark?" Like, and then Jesse's like, Oh, I guess technically we have one more son. It's like, he's over there, you know, with the sheep. And so, and Samuel's like, you didn't call all your sons to this? This was like kind of a big deal. And so they call David in, and sure enough, David comes in and they anoint David right there. So David, as a young man, probably 17, 18, something like that, is anointed the next king of Israel. That word is not fulfilled for some time. Now, I just want to take a quick pause. One of the things about prophecy that I was not aware of until I had to learn it firsthand, sometimes, and actually many times, we get these words and we think, the Lord spoke this thing about my destiny. I'm supposed to do this. The Lord has given me this calling or this gifting or this position or whatever. And we think that it's going to happen like that. I want to tell you that one of the lessons I had to learn was that God speaks many times in decades and sometimes in generations. I'll tell a quick story. When we first started prayer meetings, we were learning about the priesthood, and much of what was, I mean, just earth-shattering to our way of thinking was that there was this priesthood outside of the Levitical priesthood, this priesthood that David set up that was an expression that was ministering these spiritual offerings to God, and it was about ministering to God, not just ministering to people. And we're learning about the priesthood throughout 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles. I remember going in those early years, and I'm probably thinking 06, 07, you know, that time frame. And we're learning about the priesthood. I'm like, oh my gosh, those books, those six books, 1 and 2 Samuel, Kings and Chronicles, I was like, oh, they make so much more sense. I viewed those as like the Midwest, like the flyover states, like those are the chapters that you just like, you know, you just go through. They made so much more sense when I was, sorry, everyone from the Midwest. I viewed those as like just the ones that you just breeze past, but they had so much content about the priesthood that David established. And so we're learning about this, and we're praying, and I'm like, Lord, raise up a modern day priesthood, and the Lord basically said, you are one. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm supposed to be one of these modern day priests. And I'm thinking, and at that time, Brad had just, he was in the process of raising his own support, quitting his full-time job to do the house of prayer full-time. And I knew that that was part of my destiny too. And I really thought it would be in that season, but it ended up not being for another 10 years. And for a number of years, I'm waiting. I'm like, Lord, you said this thing, but it hasn't happened yet. I don't see any open door. And it's like, man, Lord, you speak in decades. Finally, the Lord gave the clearance, and it was actually specifically about a decade. He was saying, I want you to wait a decade before this happens. And I didn't understand that. I understand it a lot more. It had to do with me being equipped and had to work out a lot of my junk and stuff, but also there's a timing of it, and there's the grace of the Lord. But the Lord speaks in different time frames than we do. So anyway, all that to say, David is anointed king of Israel when he's probably 18, but he actually does not become king over Judah until he's 30. So there's a good long wait. And for an 18-year-old, a 12-year-old pause on something is like an eternity. I look back now as you know, I'm about to be 40 this year, and I'm thinking, 10 years, that's a whole 10 years, but it's not that long. 10 years goes like that. I've done that four times already, you know. You look at a decade very differently as you get a little bit older, but he's anointed king when he's 18. He actually takes his position as a 30-year-old, and then about 8 years later, over the whole kingdom. Now, here's probably the biggest indicator of David's vow that he made when he was a youth, when he's 12 years old. The first thing that David does when he's king, the first order, you know, we think about the first 100 days of a new presidency, And that's when all the photo shoots come out of the presidency. They're signing their presidential orders. You know, that's when they get all the photo ops. David's first kingly order that he does as soon as he's king, go get the Ark of the Covenant. It had been off in you know, on a hill, put away, not tended to. The first thing that David does when he's king is he starts making good on the vow that he made when he's 12. He said as a youth, I will not rest, I will not give myself sleep or slumber to my eyelids until something specific happens, until God gets the respect, the honor, the glory that he's due. And the first thing that he does when he finally has authority to do it is he starts to make good on that promise. As the first administrative order in his kingship, he sends a party to go and get the Ark of the Covenant, to bring it into the capital city. Now, we read about it, and it doesn't go over too well. He didn't read the fine print. He clicked acknowledge, you know, like we all do. When you get the terms of service, it's like, boop, you know, just come on, download already. He kind of does one of those, and a couple guys end up getting killed because of it. The glory breaks out. They mishandle the Ark of the Covenant, and David's kind of freaked out, and they end up setting up the Ark of the Covenant in a temporary location, the house of Obed-Edom. And it's there for a few months, and David is probably kind of like, Lord, I was really trying to do right, but something really unexpected happened. These couple guys, like I sent a couple of my best guys to go do this, and they died because of the breakout of the glory. Lord, what do I do? And he's, you know, he's kind of healing from that and probably trying to process all that. But what he notices is the house of Obed-Edom starts like, oh my gosh, that dude's garden is like really taking off. And his, like, he's starting to like get really rich. What is happening at Obed-Edom's house? Like, he starts getting like ripped, and like Obed-Edom is like starting to like get jacked and stuff. He's like, oh my gosh, this guy is like really prospering. What's happening? The glory of God resting in his house, and there's just prosperity, and David's convinced again. He's like, okay, this was a good idea. Let's just go back and read the fine print. Okay, you're supposed to take the Ark of the Covenant on poles, and it's supposed to have. So David goes all out, and he starts bringing the Ark of the Covenant, and he does it right this time, and he sets up the Ark of the Covenant on Mount Zion. Now, he establishes as a part of this, new expression of the priesthood. He sets up a tent around it. He sets up singers and musicians, and he establishes within that first kind of movement of the first administrative order, he sets up night and day prayer. He sets up perpetual 24/7 singers and musicians. There's thanksgiving. There's praises going forth. And what ends up happening is Israel begins to experience its first season of revival related to the Ark of the Covenant and the presence of God being tended to the way that it was supposed to. Okay, so David had this commitment. He had this this love for the presence of God. He establishes it. We in the last session that we did, he goes and he purchases he's like, I am going to purchase this land. I won't give to the Lord something that costs me nothing. And I just want to say, like, I'm not saying that message was you know, something keystone or like pivot or whatever. Since then, I've noticed something kind of different in our community. Like, the idea, and a lot of it, that song that Caitlin was recommending, like, she was like, hey, you guys really should listen to this song. Hey, you guys should really listen to this song. Hey, have I told you about this song, that costly song? And I'm just like, man, there's something. Like, even last night at the prayer room, there's been this response of like, man, the worth of God. Anyway, I think the Lord's doing something in our community right now, and it's just been really sweet. And I think it's in the same vein of what David was saying in this verse, 2 Samuel 24. We looked at it last time, where he's about to purchase the land, and the landowner's like, David, you're the man, you're the king, I'm gonna give it to you. You don't have to pay for anything. He's like, no, I will not give to the Lord something that costs me nothing. I want it to be costly. I know that there's something that happens in my heart when it costs me something. And so David gives this lavish offering, and that's a indicator of, or a kind of a good picture of what was going on, a shift that was happening in the community or in the nation. And so he sets up night and day prayer, and he establishes it, and there's this ongoing ministry to the Lord. Okay, a couple of the things that I want us to look at as we're starting to wrap up here. So as a result of this, we kind of, if you know any history about either Israel or England or any of the countries that have like kingships and stuff like that, we know how monarchies work. The way that it's supposed to happen is the king has a son, and then that son becomes king, and then that king has a son, and that son becomes king. Like, it's passed down through the bloodline. When the kingdom was ripped from Saul, that broke kind of the idea of the monarchy, and it reestablishes with David. And then it continues kind of the way that it was supposed to, or the ideal way for kings to be passed down through the generations. But one of the very unique and interesting things about the way that David receives his kingship is he also receives this word that the Messiah is going to come through his bloodline. He's like, David, you are something special. Even from your youth, I saw that you had this thing in your heart. I just love that about you. You did something different in your generation. You established this night and day prayer expression, this new priesthood of ministry to me, and I'm going to do something unique. I'm going to cause the Messiah to come through your bloodline. And it's like, whoa, that's as big a deal as it gets. Now, one of the things that I think about whenever Jesus was walking the earth, I want to look at Matthew 1:1 and then Matthew 12:23. The first thing in the Gospels that's listed to describe Jesus the Messiah is that he's the son of David. And then later in Matthew 12:23, as Jesus is walking around, the way that people are questioning, like, could this be the son of David? Like, the characteristic of the Messiah is totally related to being the son of David. There's this unique way that heaven viewed David and brought about the way that the Messiah would come and into being that's related to David. That's not just historical, that's also future. I think about what an interesting scene this is going to be when we're, you know, up in heaven in the New Jerusalem, and we're going to like be able to see David. And if they're ever together, it's like, oh my gosh, that's Jesus, the son of David. And what is David's response to that? Like, oh my gosh, the Messiah is like my son, you know? What a remarkable thing that the Messiah is associated with David. David had an unusual commitment in his youth. David had an unusual zeal for his house, zeal for God's house. David had not just a vow, but the work of his life was to establish a priesthood. David helped to fulfill the strategic purposes of his generation. I think about our own time, our generation, and I believe that the Lord has purposes of this generation. As we survey kind of what's happening right now in the nation and really internationally, the Lord is doing something unique. He's purifying his people. He's reestablishing the house that David had had established. Amos 9:11 says that he would reestablish, that he would resurrect the tabernacle of David. I believe that the Lord is doing that in our hour. When David was a king, one of the things that he did, worship team, you can come on up. One of the things that David did as a way of his life, I'd imagine kings are pretty busy. I've never been a king, but I'd imagine as busy as, you know, I am, I have a job role and administrative tasks and things like that. I bet kings are pretty busy. One of the things that David made sure was the way of his life was that he would spend his time, that he would spend time. He made it a priority to minister to the Lord. Psalm 27:4 says this, "One thing I ask from the Lord, this only do I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple." David made this a priority, not only every day, but all the days of his life. So not just the days of the week, but for decades. David saw something that was not just, I can set it and forget it. I set up the tabernacle there, God, I did it. It was not a checklist item for him. This was something that David wanted to do. David wanted to be in the presence of God. David grew up in a climate that he saw as a crisis, that there was no presence of God, and he did something about it. And I believe that the Lord is raising up those like David, even in our midst, that there's a presence of God crisis in our land. I believe this community has purposes to help fulfill in this generation. Oh, that it would be said of us that our congregation helped to fulfill the purposes of God in our generation. I love that we have, you know, a mile from us, just north of us, the prayer room. The prayer room is the mission of this congregation. We're currently sitting at 22 hours a day. We have not yet gone 24/7. I think that there's something beautiful about that lavish offering that we've given him over these past 18 years. And I know that it's in our heart to get to that 24-hour mark, that it would be unbroken. The Lord is doing something in this generation that is unique, and I believe that we have a part to play. I believe that, as Isaiah 55 said, that we can look to David's life as a witness, as a testimony, that we could look to the life of David as one who was unwavering, as one who would give ourselves something costly, something that costs us something, that it would be meaningful, that it would be something that we would help contribute toward. And so this morning, as we close, I want to invite you to stand. I want to pray the Lord would give us grace to help fulfill the purposes of God in this generation, that it would not be said of us that we just sat around as the presence of the Lord was absent or lacking, and that we were okay with that. That would be the mark of this house. That we would labor to establish a resting place for the Lord.
This concludes this teaching from Forerunner Fellowship. For more information about our congregation, visit forerunnerfellowship.org. Thank you.